So it is something I think that we could benefit from here at Eastside. I believe a lot of congregations could. And I think it will be extremely helpful to us as we think about, from Numbers chapter 16, this rebellion that's led by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. If you go back into that text, and we'll be looking primarily at the text in Numbers 16 this morning, if you go back into that text, if you look at the context just a couple of chapters earlier, you find that, well, after making a covenant with the Israelites at Sinai, the early days of God's relationship with His chosen people, with this incipient nation, those early days were very rocky, to say the least. When we come to Numbers 13 and 14, you remember the 12 spies were sent out to spy out the land. God was going to give them the promised land. But 10 of those spies come back with an evil report. They basically say, we can't take it. God is very disappointed in that. And so that, coupled with their constant complaining and the testing of the Lord, causes the Lord to declare that the unbelieving adults would not enter the promised land. And you can look back in Numbers chapter 14 and verse 22, and you can see the pronouncement there of God. It says, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have put me to the test now these 10 times, and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. So God has had it with Israel. He's had it especially with these unbelievers who have seen sign after sign from Him, miracle after miracle, wondrous work after wondrous work, and yet they refuse to believe in Him. They refuse to trust Him. They refuse to do things His way. Time and time again, they question Him. They test Him. They complain. And God basically says, I've had it up to here. I've had enough. You're not going to the promised land. That surely had to be a serious blow to these people. That brings us then, just a chapter over, to Numbers chapter 16. And we open up the reading there, and let me read verses 1 through 3 to start our story. Korah, the son of Ishar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram were the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? So here is the rebellion. Who were these people who are coming to Moses and Aaron and accusing them of taking too much upon themselves? Well, first of all, you had Korah, and I guess he is the leader and instigator of the whole thing. He's mentioned in the New Testament in connection with this rebellion. We'll look at that a little bit later. But Korah, along with Abiram, Dathan, and On, conspired with some 250 tribal leaders to challenge the authority of Moses and Aaron and the priestly leadership that Aaron had. So Korah is a Kohathite. He is a member of the tribe of Levi. He was actually a cousin of Moses and Aaron. You can read that back in Exodus chapter 6 and verse 21. But although he was a Levite, he was plainly not satisfied with his position, the responsibility. The Kohathites were responsible for transporting the elements of the sanctuary or the tabernacle. He apparently, as it comes out a little bit later, wanted to be a priest. Just the service of being a Levite wasn't enough for him, and he wanted some of the authority and the power that Moses and Aaron had. His unwillingness to accept his role, I believe, was a basis for the seed of his rebellion. He was dissatisfied with what he was doing. He wanted to do something greater, something more. He wanted more power. Now, Dathan and Abiram and On were not Levites. They were Reubenites. Their ancestor, as you may recall, Reuben, was the firstborn of Jacob. He had been deposed, or disposed, I should say, from being first among the tribes. He was replaced, you remember, by God's choice of Judah, who would be the first and would be the ruler. Dathan and Abiram and On sort of share in Korah's spirit of rebellion, and they join in. They think that they too should have more power. Maybe that goes back to the fact that Reuben was the firstborn son, but he didn't get all the power. The scepter was not going to come through Reuben. It was going to come through Judah. In any case, here you have Dathan, Abiram, and On. And what I like to say when I get here, of course, is that On was a little off in his thinking. He was just a little bit wrong in his approach to what he should be doing and what God wanted him to do. Besides these four individuals, there were 250 princes. They're called men of renown. They apparently already had a lot of influence, but they developed an attitude of dissatisfaction toward Moses' leadership. It may be, we don't know what all their motivation was. Again, just a couple chapters earlier, they had been sentenced to death because of their rebellion. It could be that once you've been sentenced to death and maybe you don't feel like it's justified, that you get a little bit bitter about that. And that may be part of what is motivating them here. We're not fully told. They may have interpreted Moses' leadership and Aaron's leadership as a slight against their own holiness and against their own ability. We don't know all of the motivations. But what we do know that is this. All of them were rebellious, and all of them were plainly envious of the roles that Moses and Aaron had, and they were bitter against the leadership of Moses and Aaron, a leadership that God had ordained and chosen. In James chapter 3 and verses 14, 15, and 16, James says, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above. It is earthly, it is sensual, it is demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. Well, the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and these 250 men just epitomizes what James is describing in James chapter 3. Here is envy, here is self-seeking, and so confusion and every evil thing will follow. It's a tremendous negative example for us. What were the complaints that they had against Moses when they came to complain? First of all, they say Moses and Aaron had set themselves above the rest of Israel. You take too much on yourselves. And if you skip on down to verse 13, is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us? And so they accuse Moses of acting like a prince. He just thinks he's too big for his britches. He just thinks he's so great. He's acting like he's the prince over us. And they just couldn't stand that. So they complain that Moses and Aaron, notice, you've set yourself. You act like a prince. You're not a prince. You don't have this authority. You've set yourselves above Israel. You set yourselves. You've done this yourself. That's their accusation. And notice in verse 14, fascinating, it says, moreover, you have not brought us into the land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? Here in the context, Moses had told them to do some things. They're not going to do them. But they accuse him, Moses, of being responsible for not bringing them into the promised land. Now, we just read in chapter 14 who was responsible for that. They themselves were. And it wasn't Moses who really initiated the promise of the land flowing with milk and honey. That was God. But they're blaming Moses for their failures. They're appealing to sort of a false sense of justice, to a false sense of fairness and equality. And None of it's going to work. You see, the problem there with the Israelites, the problem wasn't one of leadership at all, was it? I want you to think about this with me. Was the reason they weren't going into the promised land, was that a failure of leadership? God was going to give them the promised land. All they had to do was believe and trust Him. Moses wasn't a failure as a leader. The problem wasn't with God. It wasn't with Moses. The problem wasn't with leadership at all. It was with followership. There, attitudes, their actions had made their leaders, both God and Moses, look bad from a human perspective. The actions of the Israelites had brought reproach on the name of God, had brought reproach on the name of Moses. But it wasn't God's fault. It wasn't Moses' fault. It was the Israelites' fault that they weren't going to the promised land. Don't we like to blame others for our own failures, don't we? I was watching a baseball game the other night. Atlanta Braves closer, one of the best pitchers in the National League, blew it, let the other team score. And the commentators were saying, you know, about the manager, the coach, Freddy Gonzalez, they're saying he can't go out there and throw it for him. That's the truth, isn't it? The coach can't go out there and throw the ball for him. The follower's got to do his job. I heard of an elder in a congregation showing up to a gathering of Christians one day, and he was wearing a baseball cap, and the baseball cap had two bills. It didn't have just one bill, it had two bills, one going out each side. And it had this old saying written across it, and the saying was, "I am their leader, which way did they go?" It's not a problem of leadership, it's a problem of followership a lot of times. That the followers, they got good leaders, but they're not following their leaders. But those were the complaints. "Moses and Aaron, you've set yourselves up over us, failed to bring us to the promised land." Think about some of the characteristics of these rebels. They want others to submit to them, but they're not willing to submit themselves to authority. It's kind of like husbands that I've met over the years who are unkind and demanding to their wives. They expect their wives to submit to them. And they'll go to Ephesians 5:25, "You're supposed to be submissive to me." But they don't submit to the Lord. They won't respect the authority that they're under. They just want their wife to submit to their authority. And these men are critical of Moses and refuse to be submissive or accountable themselves to authority. They want to be in authority, but they won't submit or be accountable to authority themselves. And so when Moses tells them to come up in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 12, they respond, "We will not come up. We're not going to do what you say. We will not do what you say." They dislike and do not trust the organizational chart. They don't understand the organizational chart. You know what I'm talking about? Most organizations have, you know, you got an organization like a business, you know, you've got a president and you've got vice presidents here and directors of marketing and all of this and this all the way down to the person that's working in the plant producing whatever's being produced. And that's an organizational chart. They didn't like that. They didn't like their place in the organizational chart. They weren't going to respect that. Let me tell you something. If you cannot submit to God's delegated authority, if you cannot submit to the person that God has placed over you, you cannot submit to God. You won't do it. You're not doing it. If you can't submit to the person that God's placed over you, and whether you're talking about civil government, whether you're talking about in the home, whether you're talking about in the church, if you can't submit to the person God's placed over you, you are just rebellious. That's a sad reality, but it is reality. And it's one that I think folks need to come face to face with. these people on this occasion needed to see that. They lacked an understanding of authority, an appreciation of it. They did not appreciate the works and the power of God. We've already seen that in Numbers 14. That's one thing God accused them of. You haven't appreciated what I've done, all the works, the mighty works I've done in your midst. In Psalm 106 and verse 7, our fathers in Egypt, the writer says, did not understand your wonders. They did not remember the multitude of your mercies. These people who came up out of Egypt, they didn't appreciate the power, the wonder, the awesomeness of God for all that He'd done. They didn't respect Him for all of that. And they did not appreciate their own God-given position. Going back into our text in Numbers chapter 16, look at verses 8 and 9. Moses, in his response to the sons of Korah and the sons of Levi, says this. He says, "Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to Himself and to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to serve them, and that He has brought you near to Himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi with you? Are you seeking the priesthood also?" The thing is, the Levites, if I could use modern language, they didn't have a very bad gig. I mean, it was a good job. They had a good job. They got to come near to the Lord in the tabernacle. They were supported by the tithes and offerings of the rest of Israel. It was wonderful work. It's how I feel about preaching today. I mean, it's hard to complain about being a gospel preacher. It is wonderful work. You get to labor in spiritual things with good people, and there's just a lot of wonderful things. It's hard to complain about. But they did not appreciate the position that God had placed them in, the work that God had given them to do. They weren't appreciative of that. We don't like our position. We don't like our job. We want to do something else. We want to be people who are in charge. And so they failed to appreciate the very work that God had given them to do. And in doing that, of course, they were failing to appreciate God Himself. How did Moses respond to all of this? Back up a little more in the context. Now, I know I'm going to kind of going helter-skelter a little bit, but look at Numbers 16, verses 4 and 5. After they first come to him with this rebellion, Moses, when he heard it, he fell on his face. And I believe there he's probably praying to God. Certainly he's very, very distraught with this rebellion. And after he fell on his face and apparently prayed to God, he then spoke to Korah and to all his company, and he said, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is His and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to Him. That one whom He chooses, He will cause to come near to Him." Moses calls on God. He points out, as we've already noticed, the rebels' disdain for their God-given work. And he says that God is the one who has chosen His leaders, and God is the one who will show who His leader is. Skip on down back to verse 11. It says, "Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord." Their rebellion really wasn't against Moses and Aaron. It was against God who'd appointed Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron were there by the authority of God. I think we understand that. So here's the response of Moses. "I'm relying on God. I'm relying on God's choice. Your problem is you don't respect God's choice," is what he tells them. "You don't respect where God has put you. I'm going to rely on what God has ordained." And then look at the response of God to the rebellion. First thing that happens is God shows His glory to the whole congregation. In verse 19, "Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation." I don't know what that was, but it must have been an awesome sight, whether it was the Shekinah or the pillar of cloud or whatever it might have been. But God showed them His glory. And surely that was an awesome and fearful sight. God prepared them to destroy the entire congregation. Read with me in the next few verses, Numbers chapter 16, Verse 20, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and said, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation that I may consume them in a moment." God's ready to destroy them all. But notice the leadership of Moses, God's chosen leader, what he does. Along with Aaron, apparently, they fell on their faces. The "they" there, I believe, is Aaron and Moses from verse 20. They fell on their faces and said, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation?" So then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." And Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram. The elders of Israel followed him, and he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart now from the tents of these wicked men." Notice rebellion is wickedness. Rebellion against the authority of God. Rebellion against God's chosen leaders is wickedness. And Moses says, "Get away from their tents." So they got away from all around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives and their sons and their little children. And Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up, all and all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord." And it came to pass as he finished speaking all these words, the ground split asunder under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, and their households, and all the men with Korah, and all their goods. What a horrifying sight it must have been. What a horrifying experience it must have been for Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and their households just to be swallowed up. You know, you see these pictures of earthquakes swallowing up whole houses. It's a fearful thing. Again, just last night I was noticing on the news about a sinkhole that's swallowed up a house down in Florida. It's a horrific sort of thing. Just think about the ground opening up and swallowing you, and then witnessing that or experiencing that. How horrifying. Israel saw that happen. And besides that, Israel sees fire come down from the Lord and consume the 250 rebels. So you've got the four men and all of their households plus 250 rebels, fire from heaven, these men who had censers and they were trying to be priests to the Lord, and God sends fire and just burns them all up. Again, what a horrifying sight that must have been. You know what God, part of the last of this story, while most of us remember this part, part of the last of it we may not remember. You know what God tells orders to be done with those censers in which they were burning the incense? He tells them that they be basically hammered out and used as a covering for the altar, so that people will remember this event, that they will remember not to rebel against God's chosen way of doing things, not to rebel against those that God has authorized to do His work. If you look at, again, in Numbers 16, verse 39, Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers, which those who were burned up had presented, and they were hammered out as a covering for the altar, to be a memorial to the children of Israel, that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should come near to offer incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his companions, just as the Lord had said to him through Moses. What a lesson. These people had to learn the lesson, right? You see people swallowed up by the earth. You see fire come down from heaven. You have a memorial set up right at the altar with these bronze censers being sort of hammered out around the altar, so you'll remember that. You'll remember that from now on. You will never forget. You will never forget this lesson. You will never again rebel against the authority of God or His chosen ones. Right? You'll never forget. until the next verse. And on the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." And you say, "Are you kidding me?" How different are we? Really, how different are we? I hope we are. I hope we've learned the lesson that these people would not learn and did not learn. There's a wonderful story here. God is really angry with the children of Israel again, and He's about to destroy them all, and He sends a plague among them. And by order of Moses, Aaron quickly gets his censer and stands between the dead and the living to stop the plague. 14,000 Israelites were killed as a result of this rebellion. But Aaron, as the priest of God, stands between the dead and the living, just like our high priest does for us today, to save our souls from ourselves. We need to all deplore the attitude of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. It's dangerous. It exists even sometimes in the church today. And it's mightily destructive. In the Epistle of Jude, in verse 8, Jude talks about dreamers that defile the flesh and reject authority. He says they reject authority and they speak evil of dignitaries. He says Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him an evil or reviling accusation, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." But these people, the ones he's talking about here, the ones who reject authority, they speak evil of whatever they do not know. Whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit and have perished in the rebellion of Korah. People who do not respect authority, perishing in the rebellion of Korah. They are spots in your love feast. In other words, they can be right in the middle of a congregation, while they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves. They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, late autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots. It may have been that Korah, Dathan, and Abiram thought themselves to be pretty important people. You had 250 people who were said to be representatives of the congregation. They are people, the Bible says, who were renowned. They might have thought themselves to be something special. They are clouds without water. They are trees without fruit. There's nothing to them. They don't respect the authority of Almighty God. I have time this morning to say everything I'm hoping to say Thursday night. But let me give you the conclusion of the lesson just real quickly. Let's honor and respect God's leaders. Let's honor and respect them in government. Powers that be are ordained of God, Romans 13 says. And I may not like all of the policies of our government. I may not like all of the policies of certain politicians. But I had better respect. That was written in Romans 13. I make this point regularly. Paul wrote Romans 13 to respect the powers that be, to give tribute to whom tribute, honor to whom honor. He's talking about government officials. He wrote that when Nero, who's probably one of the most vile leaders ever to sit on a throne in the history of mankind, was sitting on the throne of the Roman Empire. Paul says you better respect him. You need to respect people in the home. Children need to respect their parents. Honor your father and mother. Rebellion against parents is same sin as Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Wives, submit to your husbands. Rebellion against your husbands, disrespecting them, is the same sin as Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Same city. And when we come into the church, we have elders in the church who are elders because the Holy Spirit has made them elders. That's what Paul says in Acts 20 and verse 28. The Holy Spirit has made them elders. Now, they're not inspired men. They're capable of making mistakes. We understand that. But we need to respect them as God's ordained leaders. We need to be obedient, submissive, Hebrews 13, 17 says, that they may do their work with joy and not with grief. How about us this morning? Are we respecting God's authority? Or do we speak against it? Do we rebel against it? Do we refuse to submit to it? Do we want to take charge ourselves? A lot of things come up in the home, in the church, in government. And I've had the experience a lot of times, maybe you have too. Maybe you're at a restaurant with somebody and you're just chit-chatting about the events of current events of the day, what's been on the news. You can talk with your friend there. And you know what? In about 20 minutes, most of the time, doesn't matter who I'm with, we can solve all the world's problems. Y'all can do that, can't you? Solve all the world's problems. But not really. Not really. And it might be, you know, think something goes on at East Side. And you say, well, you know, if it were my choice, I would do this or I'd do it that way or whatever. But you know what? It's not. It's our elders. And we don't really know all that's involved and what they're facing. Same thing happens in the home. Kids, you know, if I could tell my parents how to deal with this, here's what, you know, they need to listen to me, what they're supposed to do. But no, that's not going to work. Let's respect our leaders, because in doing that, we're respecting God. You respect God this morning, you're willing to obey Him when it comes to what you need to do to be saved. What you need to do to make your life right with Him. Would you do that right now as we stand in